This episode of the FitCast is brought to you by the PTAdvantage.com, an online personal training solution to help trainers save time and make more money. It is hands down the best resource that I've found for coaches and trainers that want to train people online. Check them out at the PTAdvantage.com. Well, welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode 276. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have along with me from Examine.com. Saul is not back, but I got Curtis Frank. Curtis, how you doing?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Doing good. I know we're up a little bit early today, but you know, it's going to be great to get into some research and get into really what you guys do over at examine.com, and we're going to be hitting on some really cool topics and some hot topics that people have been fighting about on the internet and, you know, through the media and stuff like that. So it'd be good to clear some of this stuff up. But first, I didn't really talk about this with Saul, but I wanted to really ask you, like, what is the goal of what you guys are doing at examine.com, because you guys have really kind of blown up in the last year or two. And, you know, I want to make sure if people are interested, they get over to the website.
We have a lot of sort of minor sub goals that we're aiming for, but the main goal that we're aiming for is that we want to be a large first reference database on anything related to nutritional supplements and health in general. And we want to be completely free of any bias or potential conflict of interest, because most of the information online comes from sources which could be potentially biased, could be have their information skewed in such a way to sell products or just sell subscriptions and all that stuff. So for that, we have most of our information free. We're disconnecting ourselves from all potential conflicts of interest. Recently, we actually took off the Amazon affiliate links because that was tangentially a conflict of interest. And so because of that, we're just eventually aiming to be the reference database which people can actually put their faith into more than other sources.
That's really interesting, because we've had sponsors and stuff like that come to us in the past. And really, it seems like just about everybody out there is trying to sell some sort of supplement or some kind of blend of, you know, magical goodness for people to get the results that they want. And, you know, you see it on many different websites across the web. There is pretty much bias wherever you go. So you guys are really just, you're not taking any kind of advertising money. You're not doing, now it sounds like, no kind of affiliate money from even online retailers.
We used to be supported by the Amazon affiliate links, but even then it would just be a sort of, you click on it, you're sent to the Amazon search. You're not sent to any particular product. That was, at the time, the best we could do to actually have some form of income. Mm-hmm. Now that we have the supplement reference guide, we can get ahead. We can pay all the necessities with just that. So because we now are able to support ourselves, we've dropped the Amazon links and we're fully independent.
So let's say, you know, you guys have some kind of, you come into the office and you say, all right, this week we're going to look into, you know, the benefits of fish oil. What is that process like? Do you just basically go to like PubMed, get every single study that you can possibly look at in terms of, you know, research based on fish oil, and then just go through everything and then figure out what wasn't, you know, what's considered to be a good study, what had some, you know, defects in the process? Or how do you guys go about, you know, getting the information that you put together into the book?
Fish oil is a sort of tough topic to touch on because, like, our exam page is well over 800 citations and we're nowhere near done. Fish oil is by far the largest topic to research. But the process generally starts for all supplements. You do a basic search in PubMed, first of human trials to see if there are any, and if not, just reviews or whatever is likely to give you the best sort of general overview of the supplement. You pick what seems like the most interesting point. This is mostly a judgment call, usually from me, but now our editors that we recently hired can also partake in this. But if something is likely to be active, something is promising because it's unique, or if something is just likely to occur in the body. there are a lot of studies which sort of, I guess, examine what a herb or a supplement could do, but they wouldn't apply to oral supplementation. We try to just look for the studies that are relevant. And when we do, we collect all the information possible, put it on the page as sort of a preliminary research, and then over the course, well, I guess actually indefinitely, we always revisit the page to edit particular sections or the page in general. We try to keep everything up to date, and just whenever we revisit the page, we try to refine the information as best as possible. So it's not like one linear process. It's kind of like a preliminary process to get the page active, and then we revisit it as many times as needed indefinitely to keep the page updated. And anyone can offer their input, and then we, if the input is valid and like worth an edit, then we will get back to the page and edit it accordingly.
Okay, so that's a super interesting aspect for me, because I'm one of those guys, I mentioned on the show in the past, I like to know what you guys know, but I'm never going to put in the work to go through all these research studies and stuff like that. Like, it is just very good that we have, you know, guys like you and, you know, guys like Alan Aragon's Research Review, because you guys can digest it and then just give us the answers. And you guys have built up such a great trust over these last couple of years. It's just a great resource out there. People, you know, make sure you check out the website. But we have a ton of topics to talk about. And one of the things that I wanted to start off with was, you know, creatine, because we've, you know, people out there have been, you know, touting creatine supplementation in terms of the benefits that you're going to get in performance and muscle building. But you guys have been kind of actually looking at some health aspects aside from performance. So what have you guys been seeing in the research?
It's actually super interesting how we came to research the health aspects, because when every now and then someone recommends against creatine supplementation, and when you do recommend against creatine supplementation, they always go back to one point, that oral ingestion of creatine suppresses endogenous creatine synthesis. So basically, if you eat creatine, your body will synthesize less creatine. This is true, and it's actually beneficial for some weird reason. Creatine is an incredibly important molecule in the human body, and because of that, it needs to be synthesized. The synthesis process actually costs the body quite a bit. Have you heard of the molecule called S-adenosylmethionine? It's sold to a supplement called SAME.
No.
Well, it's a very good supplement, like good for joint health, good for fighting depression, and it is horribly expensive. But it's an important molecule in the body. It just, I guess, supports a bunch of metabolic processes via methylation. It also supports creatine synthesis. So if you suppress creatine synthesis by just consuming it, you preserve some of this S-adenosylmethionine. Then since you have more of it floating in your body, it can go around and do other beneficial things. Of those beneficial things, right now we can potentially, creatine might reduce liver fat buildup. So that's kind of opposite of what some people say it somehow harms the liver. It may actually be beneficial. Beyond that, it can reduce a molecule called homocysteine, which might be atherogenic, like build up plaque in arteries. And additionally, creatine's little ATP buffering effect that we all know and love in muscle cells might also work in the actual endothelium of the blood vessel. And when it buffers ATP, it seems that immune cells and other stuff adhere to the endothelium less. So because of that, creatine can potentially be a liver health supplement, and it may also reduce the atherogenic process, and like daily supplementation for quite a few years might be cardioprotective.
But one other thing before we get too deep into this is that
yes,
you know, there's always different recommendations in terms of how much creatine that you should take in. And then, you know, also, is this something that, you know, males and females should take in? Does the dosage change based on gender or size? And also, to be honest, like, there are many different forms of creatine, and obviously kind of like the gold standard that we talked about a lot is just, you know, creatine monohydrate. What's up with all these, you know, different factors? Are these things that we need to consider?
In regards to the dosing of creatine, I'm just going to assume monohydrate here because it's always used in the scientific studies. Mm-hmm. There is a loading phase of 20 grams a day for 5 days, then maintenance. that works. It is not needed, but it works. So if you ever decide to do a loading phase, more power to you. Mm-hmm. For the maintenance phase, it's just taking one dose, preferably with food, but that's not mandatory, every day indefinitely. That also works. And the dosage, 2 to 3 grams will work if you're not active. If you're moderately active, 5 grams. And then if you're an elite athlete, I'd probably recommend 8 grams. The dosage of creatine only changes because of how much creatine turnover occurs in the body. And the major determinant of that is how active your muscle tissue is. So the more active you are, the more creatine you will need to ingest. But I see no reason to go over 10 grams a day. That seems to be perfect. In regards to the forms of creatine, creatine monohydrate was the very first one, and it's just become the reference. So for every other form of creatine, you just have to say, is it better than creatine monohydrate? As of right now, no form has been able to prove itself better than monohydrate. Many of them are equivalent. So if you get magnesium chelate, creatine nitrate, all that stuff, it's fine. You can keep on using that, but it's not better than monohydrate. We recommend monohydrate because it's the cheapest. And if you get a micronized version, it's water-soluble. There's really no downsides to it. The only form that is pretty bad is a creatine ethyl ester or ethyl ether. I forget what it is right now. But basically, that form is made to pass the cell membrane easier and apparently circumvent the creatine transporter. But that works on a cellular level. When you ingest it, it just degrades in your intestines. So it doesn't even get creatine into your body. So when buying creatine, don't get ethyl ester. You can get pretty much anything else. Monohydrate is probably going to be the cheapest one for you.
All right. Makes it simple. So is there any other, you know, health benefits that people can see from creatine? And, you know, again, just to go back, any, you know, gender differences in terms of like consumption or benefits?
Here's a good transition. There is a health benefit which is gender dependent, but it only occurs in females. Creatine can potentially have an antidepressant effect. And we have, I think 4 to 5 preliminary studies showing this, but we have one very good controlled trial where in women who are taking SSRIs, the serotonin-based antidepressants, and they were not very responsive to the treatment. Supplementation of creatine preserved the responsiveness and overall caused an antidepressant effect. So creatine basically, I guess, augments or supports other antidepressants in efficacy, but only in females for some reason. I'm not exactly sure why. Okay.
Go ahead.
For the other health benefits, you know how creatine draws water into muscle cells? Creatine can draw water into pretty much any cell in which creatine accumulates in. This is most muscle cells, including cardiac tissue, liver cells, most organs, and the endothelium. And when it draws in water, it actually causes a little stress in that cell, and the cell over-exaggerates a repair mechanism. The end result is that when that cell is sort of swelling because of the presence of creatine, it's actually more resistant to stressors and damage. So this is mostly just theoretical, but creatine could just support cellular function in a very general sense by making that cell less likely to be damaged.
Some super interesting stuff. All right. All right. Let's talk about, again, another subject that you guys have been researching a lot, adaptogens, and really the compounds that are being sold on the market. And again, this is one of those things that can sometimes get tied up in like marketing hype and stuff like that. What have you guys found? Is there, you know, is the hype legit?
For some of the adaptogens, the hype is legit. For many of them, it's just not researched, so we don't know. The entire adaptogen term, from a layperson and marketing perspective, it prevents stress and reduces stress. From the scientific perspective, it's a non-specific stress resistance. Basically, it causes a little stress in the body, too small to be perceived by the organism. But then the body somehow exaggerates a response to that stress, and now you're more prepared for future stressors. Practically speaking, like when you measure the blood, if you give an adaptogen to a rat or a human and subject them to a stress, preloading with that adaptogen will have lower levels of any sort of stress response, be it anxiety, depression, serum cortisol levels, immunosuppression, or just like stomach ulceration. All those things can occur with stress, and they're all reduced when you're preloaded with an adaptogen compound. The term adaptogen is just what we see happen. We really don't know how much the stuff works. We just know that it kind of does. And in this regard, we've studied a few of them. They probably work by different mechanisms, but in the end, they do the same thing. And there's three of them which seem to be well-researched and safe enough to recommend. Ashwagandha, which is probably my favorite, rhodiola or rosea, and then Panax ginseng. Those three are probably the most well-known and supported adaptogens.
Okay, now people, I think I ran into this problem with Saul, but now that people know that there are some benefits with these, you know, how do they at least keep a, like an eye out to find that they're getting a good reputable manufacturer to get these supplements from? Because I know you guys don't want to back any supplement companies in particular, but are there any tips to make sure that if someone's going to go pick up one of these supplements, that they're at least getting like a high quality version?
If you're buying a supplement just over the counter, mm-hmm. and you look at the label, if you see a certification in regards to manufacturing, like a CGMP certification, that tends to reflect that what is on the label is actually in the pill. Furthermore, larger companies, stuff like Now Foods, Life Extension Foundation, those companies that are like in the public eye usually have better compounds for the sole reason that they have more to lose when they get sued. Smaller companies without much presence on the supplement market don't have much to lose in regards to getting sued. Larger companies that just put themselves out there have a lot to lose, and because of that, there's more incentive for them to actually give quality supplements.
Got it. So at least people have something to look out for when they're, you know, at the store. So another thing that you guys have been looking into a lot is the benefits of garlic. And I'm guessing this is not just like, you know, sprinkling some on your pizza or whatever, you know, like what kind of benefits are you seeing? And, you know, how do people, you know, make sure they're getting in an appropriate dosage of garlic to make sure that they're seeing these benefits?
Well, first, the dosage of garlic is about one clove three times a day would probably be the optimal dose. And that is quite feasible to sprinkle on the pizza. But for the benefits of garlic, they're actually quite numerous. And I don't think I can go over all of them today. The examine page is in-depth, so you can just refer to anything I say on that page at a later time. But most benefits of garlic are related to circulation. But it's really interesting because, you know, nitric oxide, correct?
I apologize. I'm muting myself because there's traffic going outside my apartment.
It's okay. But nitric oxide, it boosted in popularity a while ago, mainly because it's a small molecule that can promote circulation and potentially muscle growth. It's called a gastrotransmitter. I'm actually going to be doing a presentation on these things in a few weeks at MOVE Ottawa conference. But there's three main gastrotransmitters in the body. Nitric oxide, hydrogen sulfide, like the molecule that actually causes egg fart smell, and carbon monoxide. These things are really potent. They can get anywhere in the body, and they regulate a wide variety of processes. Garlic supplementation basically supports hydrogen sulfide signaling because it just donates sulfur to make the hydrogen sulfide with. When hydrogen sulfide signaling is supported, there is an increase in blood flow, and it works additively with nitric oxide. So those two are kind of sister molecules in a sense. It promotes the formation of new blood vessels, so angiogenesis. And just over time, it can help promote nutrient delivery to most tissues because of that angiogenesis. Just makes blood vessels where there shouldn't have been any before. And beyond that, it can also support a lot of antioxidant processes because sulfur is a good component of glutathione, one of the main antioxidant enzymes, and garlic can supplement that as well. And just secondary to all these improvements in circulation and improvements in antioxidant defense, garlic is just a food product that you can consume in your diet, and over the long term can theoretically help muscle growth by angiogenesis, but has been proven to increase cardiovascular health, blood circulation, blood lipids, and I guess just generally well-being. It also is kind of a little herbal statin drug, so it will reduce cholesterol, and although it's unreliable, it retains the potential to reduce triglycerides as well. It's just a very cardioprotective functional food.
So for, you know, I'm sure there's going to be people out there that really, you know, don't like the taste of garlic. Is this something that they can get in a supplement as well?
Only in supplement form, but it's called aged garlic extract.
Okay.
They basically just age the garlic, and in the aging process, it loses the aromatics. So you don't taste nor smell the garlic. Hmm. And even if you overdose on it, your body will not smell like garlic. Like if you eat a friggin' bulb a day, you probably will start smelling of garlic, which is why it's why I mentioned 3 cloves a day, because no one smells like garlic at that low dose, but it is effective. But yeah, aged garlic extract will not have the taste nor smell of garlic, and it has been proven effective in studies as well, so it's an alternative to take.
So you don't have to be that guy, you know, at work. It's like, man, it's that guy that, it's like, it's George. George smells like garlic again.
Read about all the benefits of curry and garlic, and then all of a sudden, there's me around you.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect storm. so let's talk a little bit. You know, obviously we're hitting on supplements, but I guess when at the end of the day, people are going to be on a budget. We got the holidays coming up too, and I'm sure people are going to be blowing tons of cash at the, you know, at the local Target and Best Buy and whatever. So we want to make sure that they're not throwing their money away on supplements that aren't really going to give them the benefit. So again, we talk a lot about this marketing hype and this, you know, this storm behind supplements. What are some of the things that are just like straight up hype? Like people, you know, really aren't going to see any benefits out of, even though there's, you know, before and after pictures on, you know, of, you know, bodybuilder that put on 50 pounds and dropped 50 pounds and all this garbage. What are the things that people should just, you know, steer clear of?
First things first, glutamine would probably be at the top of the list because it's not even the cheapest supplement out there. In regards to glutamine, theoretically and technically, it does promote muscle protein synthesis. And the more glutamine you shove in a muscle cell, the more muscle protein synthesis you get. The thing is, when you ingest glutamine, it's sort of stored in a reservoir in your intestines and liver, and they regulate the whole body exposure to glutamine. They'll give the muscles as much as they need, but there will never be an instance of some overloaded glutamine like influx to the muscle cell. The only time where glutamine could potentially build muscle is in instances where the body is undergoing, I guess, a relative glutamine deficiency, and because that the intestines and liver just cannot provide any glutamine for muscle cells. These instances have been seen in clinics for third-degree burn victims because they just go through so much glutamine trying to repair themselves. And when you do cardiovascular exercise exceeding 2 to 3 hours, like a marathon, you do use some proteins as energy. So in that instance, you could potentially use glutamine supplementation and it will increase performance a little bit. Beyond those two isolated incidents, glutamine will pretty much never influence muscle protein metabolism. And glutamine itself is heavily marketed. I believe Saul mentioned it was a $600 million industry or something. It's way too large for its lack of efficacy.
So what else? So is there anything, you know, outside of glutamine that people should keep an eye out for? I mean, I think, obviously the big ones out there that people are blowing a ton of money on, at least that we're seeing in, you know, the research that shows what people are buying is, you know, fat loss products like fat burners. And then also, you know, obviously we're seeing a lot of people like going into like these testosterone boosters and stuff like that, you know, the stuff that's kind of like behind the glass at your local vitamin shop and GNC that is so good, you know, you can't even put it out on the floor.
Oh, wow. I'm trying to think of a fat burner and testosterone booster that I would recommend. And even then, like, I'm not coming across any testosterone boosters that I can recommend that would be cost effective.
Mm.
And for fat burners, I have like three of them, but they all come with the clause of not as good as the marketing makes you think they are.
Yeah.
But the major ones that I guess are overhyped for testosterone boosting, any herb, first of all, they can be amazing libido enhancers. They can make a quality of life go up, but they do not boost testosterone. Tribulus terrestris is guilty of this for the most part because it was the first one on the market. It is a libido enhancer, and a lot of people find that their quality of life and well-being goes up with it. Like, I personally actually use Tribulus because I just like it, but it doesn't boost testosterone. It has never been shown to boost testosterone. It has no reason to boost testosterone. It's only on the market because when it's in a supplement and people feel it, they assume that testosterone is increased because they're horny all the time. Another overhyped one is D-aspartic acid. This one I need to approach a bit cautiously because technically it works on days 1 to like 14, the first 2 weeks of supplementing. But then your body adapts and it goes back down to baseline after a month. That small spike in testosterone, it reaches around 40% on day 7 and then steadily goes down after that. That isn't enough to sufficiently change any muscle growth or anything. So because that D-aspartic acid is not a practical testosterone booster, and I guess with chronic usage of it, you could actually potentially go below baseline values of testosterone. So I'm not going to recommend people don't take D-aspartic acid, but I now do recommend people not take it for more than a week or two. But even then, if someone's trying to save money, I just wouldn't recommend it at all.
Very cool. So, you know, before we do wrap up, obviously, like we mentioned a couple of times, Salt was on a couple of months ago, because you guys did put together this supplement guide, which, you know, I can't recommend highly enough. And I don't promote tons of stuff on the show these days. This is one of those things where I think if you do purchase supplements, if you do want to make sure that you are not buying stuff that's going to be ineffective or harmful, this is something that you should definitely be looking to pick up. But you guys are doing kind of like a special deal because of the, you know, coming towards the end of the year, right?
Yes, we're celebrating our 5,000th PDF sale because it is an online ebook, and since we sold 5,000 of them, we're celebrating a bit because over the next 3 days, today included, the price has been dropped from $39 to $29.
That's nothing. Come on, guys. It's $30. It's like, that's like not even, you know, a meal going out on the weekend. That's, again, it's one of those things that I think is well worth your money because it's going to save you a lot of money in the long run and just save you from throwing money down the drain. And, you know, again, I don't think there's a better, you know, group out there that's putting this stuff out that you could support. And, you know, I will mention, you know, there's going to be a link in the show notes if you want to help support the FitCast, that will help us out as well. So I would appreciate that. But, you know, other than that, like, again, the supplement reference guide is just absolutely fantastic. It's something I can't recommend highly enough. But yeah, Curtis, before I let you go, like, is there's some stuff coming up at examine.com that people should keep an eye out for, some cool things that you're working on?
We just recently finished hiring our first three candidates, and while their exact credentials are not on the tip of my tongue right now, I can assure you that they all put me to shame. We do have one PhD candidate and then two well-certified, I believe one PhD, one PharmD. They're our new editing team. So the information you see on Examine right now, which I would assume is highly quality because I've done most of it, it's only set to be better because we now have a lot more educated eyes looking over the data and trying to find consensus on the information. So I guess our team is growing, and that because of who we are and how we need a larger team of educated individuals, it is definitely worthy of celebration on our end.
Awesome. Well, congratulations to you guys. You deserve it. And, you know, again, I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys, you know, come together with in the future. It's going to be nice to have some more eyes and hands to go through all that research and stuff and get us some more answers, us the general population, things like that. So, Curtis, thank you so much for taking your time today to talk a little bit about this, and we'll definitely have to have you guys on in the future.
My pleasure.